Surrounded today by a massive concrete wall, military checkpoints, and illegal settlements.
It's imposing a system of control that I'm sure Jesus was very familiar of. If he's born today, he would be born on our side of the wall.
According to the Gospels, the most important features of Christianity have their origins in Jerusalem. The institution of the Eucharist took place while Jesus was celebrating Passover with his disciples in Jerusalem. Also, his crucifixion at the Golgotha, where Jesus remained calm, compassionate, and loving even in the face of death. And according to Christian belief, his resurrection 3 days later all happened in Jerusalem. In this way, Jerusalem constitutes a unique and holy city for Christianity. Other holy sites are associated with events from the Old Testament, the lives of Mary, John the Baptist, and the apostles, with endless more associated with later Christian saints, holy men and women, and local traditions. But Bethlehem will be a somber place this year, as the Christian of the three major churches, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic, have stated they will not be celebrating.
This year is going to be totally different. There won't be any lights. We will not have the Christmas tree. We will be mourning those who are being slaughtered in Gaza. There's a deep atmosphere of grief here, and all the churches have decided to only have religious services for Christmas.
These holy places, the indigenous Christian community and pilgrims who come to visit from all over the world, have long been the subject of violence, harassment, and intimidation by the occupation forces who have not allowed the community to worship in peace. The Temple Mount is no exception, often the subject of brutality despite being considered a holy place. It is where Jesus was first presented as an infant to the temple and its people by his holy mother Maria. It was also there where he famously taught elders of the community at the tender age of 13 and later threw out the money changers from the same temple grounds. Unfortunately, the percentage of Christians living in Bethlehem and in other occupied Palestinian territories has plummeted. With the community currently totaling under 2% of the population, the fear that Christians will one day no longer have a presence in Palestine is slowly becoming a reality. The reason is extremely clear for the indigenous worshippers.
Joining us on the show this week to discuss this important topic are two special guests. Joining us in the studio is Amir Aqil, who is a board member of Palestine Pulse, a London-based group on the path to creating a new movement led by the grandchildren of the Nakba and like-minded peers, amplifying the Palestinian liberation movement through British-based voices. And we are also extremely honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted and where human rights are suppressed. Reverend Dr. Stephen is also the director of the Institute of the Study of Christian Zionism and a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He is a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Asal. Reverend, if I can come to you, please, first. Thank you again for joining us. Why do Christians have such an affinity with Palestine and Jerusalem?
We have a strong affinity for Palestine in particular because it's the location of where God's redemptive plan was achieved in and through the Lord Jesus. He was born in Bethlehem. He lived much of his life in the Galilee, and he was arrested, crucified, and rose again in Jerusalem. So the central tenets of the historic life and teaching of Jesus revolve around Palestine. And not surprisingly, it was where the church was founded among his followers. And so the Palestinian Christian community represents the indigenous mother church, if you like, for the global church today.
Thank you for that. I know it seemed like such an obvious question, but, you know, I feel like the Christian community often don't speak enough about the relevance of Palestine. And Amira, yourself, who has lived as a Palestinian, lived in her homeland and have been given the privilege of traveling extensively because you are British, obviously it's a privilege that other Palestinians don't have. Let me ask you about what you've seen in your time in Palestine about the oppression of the indigenous Christian community there at the hands of the occupation and extremist settlers?
Yes, so the way that we see it as Palestinians is Palestine operates as a community, and that's regardless of religion. But what I've seen personally living there is that Palestinians, Christians, Muslims, they face oppression on a daily basis, and it's the same oppression. The Christians don't get spoken about enough, which I think is tactical, but they go through the same land grabs, settler violence on a daily basis, streets they're not allowed to walk down just because they're Palestinian, regardless of their religion, facing the IOF on a daily basis, their children also getting imprisoned and arrested for false trumped-up charges, apart from the fact that, Palestinians in the West Bank also get killed quite frequently, regardless, again, of religion. The Zionists can't tell what religion you are by looking at you, and so, therefore, the Christians are persecuted the same way as any other Palestinian, hence why we say that we're a community made up of different religions. It's a lack of freedom of movement for the Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. It's a lack of religious right to practice your religion, whether going to churches or mosques. It's the same persecution that they face. I think the issue that we have is that the Christians don't get spoken about a lot because of the fact that it goes against Israel's agenda of making this a Muslim Jewish issue, where actually it's a Palestinian against Israel issue, regardless, again, of religion. So, like I said, we are one community and we act in that way. And the Palestinian Christians and Muslims go through the same thing.
It's definitely something that we've seen, the unity between the Christians and the Palestinians, on footage that has gone viral, but also in cases like Shireen Abu Akleh, who, is one of our most beloved and treasured heroines of the Palestinian liberation, doing her job and obviously attacked in cold blood and murdered by the entity. But also something that you said that was really striking to me is I found myself surprised to hear of, although I've seen it, and as a Palestinian I've grown up seeing it, I was still surprised to hear just how much repression the Christian community is suffering. And that's upsetting. It's almost like this, internalized colonization that I'm fighting. Reverend, if I can come to you for this question. As a religious leader, I'm sure that you have seen and heard these things that we've just spoken about, what Amira has attested to. We know that scholars of all Abrahamic faiths have long been the targets of pro-apartheid lobbies who have launched heavy campaigns to have them displaced from their roles if they speak about Palestine. Can you tell us about why religious leaders are targets? And if you have any experience in this matter, set the scene for us.
Well, Israel is an apartheid state. It's based on supremacism. It's a racist endeavor. And it's a settler colonial enterprise. And that's an indefensible political position. And therefore, it must make its critics, particularly those committed to human rights, it must make them appear worse to distract attention from its own crimes. So it accuses Jewish anti-Zionists, for example, as Jew haters. And it accuses non-Jews like me and others as either Holocaust deniers or anti-Semites. The way they have achieved this is by pushing a misdefinition of anti-Semitism. It's called the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance misdefinition. It's a working definition. It was never intended to be used in legal terms. But it essentially dilutes anti-Semitism from prejudice, hostility, racism towards Jews because they're Jews, but equates similar criticisms of Israel as anti-Semitism, which is entirely fallacious. It's untrue. But by imposing this new definition on particularly Western governments, churches, trade unions, universities, they have broadened out this definition. So if you criticize Israel, they'll accuse you of being anti-Semitic. In my own personal experience, I've faced 20 years or more of intimidation, where they target or critical of you, accusing you of associating with anti-Semites or Holocaust deniers and so on. One occasion, they accused me of seeking to divert church funds to Hamas in Gaza, which is entirely untrue. But they intimidate you. And if that doesn't work, they intimidate others to try and isolate you. So invitations to speak in universities or churches suddenly will be withdrawn because pressure has been put upon them not to have you speak. I encountered a complaint that was made about me in 2012, accusing me of anti-Semitism. That was resolved amicably, but then they had another go in 2018, and that led to a tribunal. It took 4 years. They couldn't find a single person to come and be a witness against me. I had 50 witnesses on my side, rabbis, academics, bishops. They couldn't find a single word of mine that was deemed anti-Semitic, and yet the tribunal found me guilty of conduct unbecoming, gave me a 12-year suspension from being an Anglican priest, so much so that one Jewish academic, Jeff Halper, called it an inquisition, and the expert witness on anti-Semitism at my tribunal, Anthony Lerman, said it's an indelible stain on the Church of England to accuse someone who's never uttered a single word against the Jews to be accused of anti-Semitism. So that's how they do it. They target academics, they target politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and clergy. And if they get one scalp, one head, everyone else keeps their heads down. And that's part of their agenda, to silence criticism where really criticism needs to be directed at them.
What an interesting story, and something that I'm sure many other religious leaders have similar stories like yourself. What I'd like to do now is have us all take a look at some examples of how Christians and their beliefs are denigrated by the Zionist Jewish occupiers of Palestine.
The genocide against the Palestinian people has brought Judaism and Jewish extremism into the spotlight. From extremist rabbis calling for Christians to be killed,
2 billion Christians, which are idol worshippers, between Chinese, Indian, Hindus, Buddhists, and Christian, at least 6.5 billion people are idol worshippers that, according to the Torah, do not have the right to live. Idol worshiper goy, it's death penalty. Not only Jews, even a goy who bow down to an idol, who believe in JC, deserve death penalty.
In my country.
To ordinary Israelis making the same murderous threats.
Are you Jewish? Do you want to honor God? That is the godly thing to do. We respect one another.
The godly thing to do is to kill you.
The godly thing is to kill me.
That's right. That's what the Torah says.
The Torah says to kill us.
The Torah says that people who worship idols such as yourself, when there is a Sanhedrin,
to kill us.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the Torah says.
So we know how the Jewish people feel about Christians, yes? That you discriminate against Christians.
Christians are idol worshippers.
You discriminate against Christians.
The Torah says that Christianity is idol worship.
You also have the same rabbis making threats to destroy churches.
Even if the United States government would say, okay, hey, you're becoming too fanatic, the government, too religious. We'll give you $1 billion extra every year to the aid. Don't touch the churches. We're not allowed to listen to them. God comes before Obama and his friends.
While it appears that for the Jewish extremist squatters in Palestine, spitting on Christians is a favored pastime. Then there is the outright blasphemy against Jesus and his pure mother.
Reverend, if I can come to you again for this question, you know, what you've, the persecution that you've faced, I'm assuming, you know, is a parallel that you can draw between yourself, the Christian Palestinians, but also Jesus as well faced similar persecution by the people of his time. Can you give us some information on that and draw some parallels for us?
I'd be pleased to. The parallels are quite significant. The first century Judaism was under foreign military occupation, the Roman Empire, and the political and religious leaders, people like Herod, the king, and the Pharisees and Sadducees, the religious leaders, were cooperating with the Roman government and oppressing the people. They were used as a means of oppressing and taxing the people. And so the parallels with Zionism today, with supremacism, with antagonism toward the poor, the marginalized, and the foreigners, the parallels are clear. Jesus was a threat to that. Even before he was born, his mother, Mary, when she was told that she was expecting him. It's called Mary's Song. She speaks about how he will bring down the rulers from their thrones. He will lift up the humble. He will fill the hungry with good things and send the rich away empty. After Jesus was born, King Herod recognized there was a threat when the Magi from Iran visited Bethlehem to worship Jesus and give him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Herod instituted a pogrom to try and have Jesus murdered as a baby. He had orders given to kill all the boys in Bethlehem under the age of two because he saw Jesus as a threat. As an adult, Jesus' very first sermon given in Nazareth speaks of how he would proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, set the oppressed free, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The year of the Lord's favor was the Jubilee, the time when slaves would be freed, when debts would be canceled, and that was what he was coming to do, to bring a revolution to the status quo. He anticipated persecution in his Sermon on the Mount, probably his most famous sermon. He says, you'll be blessed if you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets. As we follow through the life of Jesus as an adult, we see him challenging the religious leaders, challenging the status quo, the foreign rulers, turning the tables in the temple, casting out those who were exploiting the poor. And on one occasion, they tried to trap Jesus, and they said, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus said, show me a coin. And they gave him a coin, and he said, whose image is on the coin? And they all shouted out, Caesar's. He said, well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's. He was pointing out that they were using this money, therefore they were already compromising with the government, the Roman government. Yes, pay your taxes, but remember your responsibility is ultimate to God, and he is sovereign. At his trial, Pilate challenged Jesus and said, don't you realize I can have you killed? And Jesus said, you would have no authority were it not given you from God himself. God is sovereign. God is in control. All through the life of Jesus, we see how he antagonized and challenged those who were committed to a supremacism, committed to the status quo, using their power to exploit particularly the vulnerable.
And everything that you've just said about, you know, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him, and his, you know, his fight and his resilience in fighting his oppressors is actually something that we've all seen of the Palestinians currently, whether it be Christian, Muslim, or even our Jewish Palestinian community, fighting the IOF, and, you know, doing so with so much dignity and so much honor. You know, Amira, if I can come back to you, footage that we've, you know, seen of Christians in Palestine being insulted and being spat on, etc., by the community, it's gone viral. It's not new. You know, this, yet they are, as a community, you know, Israel kind of, what it does is that it propagates itself as this, the only democracy in the Middle East where everyone has their freedoms, whether it be in the religious sector or in the personal sector. What do settlers and their patrons in the Israeli regime really think about Christians, you know, from your own experience, from what you've seen?
To sum it up, I think an unwanted nuisance, because if it, it again goes against their agenda, having Christians in Palestine, where they want to, you know, make it very obvious that it's a Muslim problem, and having the Christians there is an issue, which is one of the reasons why systematically they've been pushed out, whether that be in Jerusalem or West Bank. And the population is dwindling. So if we look at, for example, in 1922, there was 10% population, a Christian population in the whole of the land, whereas now it's estimated 2% in the whole of the land. And these people aren't running away from their Palestinian brothers and sisters, but regardless of religion. They're running away from being systematically attacked by the settlers, by the regime in general, whether that's persecution, whether that's, you know, not allowing them to practice their religion, and constantly taking from them, whether it, you know, their lands, their homes. They face the same things on a daily basis as the Muslims. So I think how they see, how settlers and the regime sees them is a population in Palestine that needs to go. It needs to be pushed into Jordan. It needs to be pushed into other surrounding countries because that fits their agenda. And we've seen it. We've seen their percentage. I mean, they weren't too many to begin with. And you know, we have to remember these are the most ancient Christians in the world that we have in Palestine, and they need to be respected and looked after because at the moment they are facing a real threat of extinction.
Absolutely.
And you know, if we don't look after them and show the Western world what's happening to them, in the next 20, 30 years, we do face. We face the fact that there might not be any ancient Christians that are related to the past biblical stories on the land that Jesus was born in.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's definitely something that the Muslim community in Palestine feel very strong about. It's, you know, there has been conversations back and forth of if our mosques are bombed, you know, Christian priests have said that we will make the call for Adhan and we will be the ones to honour Islamic prayer for the community. And the same, and the inverse is true, whereas the Muslims have said if no churches exist, you know, we will make sure to honour the traditions of Christianity in the land. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us. And the same for you, Amira. This is such an enlightened conversation, and I wish that we had more time to continue it. But unfortunately, that is all that we have time for today. Thank you at home, and join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, unfaithful and untrustworthy. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that Islam emphasizes on being faithful and trustworthy. But what does the Prophet of Allah say in this regard? The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Don't be unfaithful to anything that anybody deposits with you and trusts you with. Surely Allah commands you to make over trust to their owners." Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, was the most faithful and trustworthy personality of all times. He says, "A Muslim is not untrustworthy when trusted with something, nor does he break a promise which he makes." So if we flip this saying, it means a person who is untrustworthy and breaks promises as a habit is not a Muslim in essence, right? In reality, he is not a Muslim. This is very dangerous, brothers and sisters. Sometimes we take these ethical and moral teachings of Islam lightly. But if we turn towards Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, we see that for them, these things matter a lot. And they have said and emphasized on these traits and these positive qualities that are expected for a believer to carry with utmost passion. If you look at the wording of the ahadith, you will realize how important it is for Imam Ali alayhi salam for us to be trustworthy. Again, notice the wording that Imam Ali uses to highlight the importance of being faithful and trustworthy. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of unfaithful and untrustworthiness, right? So we said that, you know, how far does this untrustworthiness goes? Let's turn towards Imam Ali alayhi salam and ask him. Amirul Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam said, keep away from untrustworthiness, for it is an opposite to Islam. Brothers and sisters, Islam has zero tolerance policy when it comes to being untrustworthy. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Kumail, we do not permit anyone to break trusts. He who quotes us otherwise, he is wrongful and sinful, and he will be punished for his forging of lies. I swear that the Messenger of Allah told me at his deathbed thrice, be trustworthy to the good and to the bad, in small and large things, even in needles and thread. Imagine how sensitive were the holy Imams and, of course, the Prophet of Allah when it comes to being trustworthy. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, who is Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth divinely appointed Imam, he says, keep on being trustworthy. I swear by him who sent Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as a truthful prophet that if the man who killed my father, that is Al-Husayn alayhi salam, deposits his dagger with me, I will certainly make it over to him. So this means even if he's such a bad person who has killed Imam Husayn alayhi salam and martyred Imam Husayn alayhi salam, yet I will not be untrustworthy towards him. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, be pious and trustworthy to anyone who deposits a trust with you. Indeed, if the killer of Imam Ali alayhi salam deposits anything with me, I will make it over to him. This is the way and the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has taken his argument that he should be immune from prosecution, which was shut down by a federal judge, to an appeals court. In court papers filed on Saturday night, 23rd of December, Trump once again tried to derail Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's case that charges him with trying to overturn the 2020 election. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. ¶¶ The American newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Trump's lawyers asked a federal appeals court to toss his 2020 election subversion case in Washington, D.C., just one day after the Supreme Court declined special counsel Jack Smith's request to take up Trump's argument that his actions are protected from criminal prosecution under presidential immunity. In a court filing to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on Saturday night, 23rd of December, Trump's attorneys reiterated their push for the appeals court to overturn a lower court's ruling that rejected the former president's immunity claim. Donald Trump introduced the argument back in October, saying his actions leading up to and surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol are protected by presidential immunity. Federal Judge Tanya Chutkan ruled earlier this month that the United States has only one chief executive at a time, and that position does not confer a lifelong get-out-of-jail-free pass. The former president is facing four felony counts alleging he was involved in a conspiracy to defraud the United States and stood at the center of a campaign to block the certification of Electoral College votes on 6th of January 2021. In the latest court filing, Trump's lawyers once again argued Trump's conduct constitutes official acts to advocate for and defend the intensity of the federal election. In accord with his view, it was tainted by fraud and irregularity. Arguing the indictment is unlawful and unconstitutional, Trump's lawyers said he must first be impeached and convicted by the Senate before he can be criminally prosecuted for his official acts as president. Before any single prosecutor can ask the court to sit in judgment on the president's conduct, Congress must have approved of it by impeaching and convicting the president. That did not happen here, and so President Trump has absolute immunity. The oral argument for the appeals case is slated for 9th of January, according to court filings. The trial is scheduled to begin on 4th of March. National broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's legal team has asked the federal appeals court to toss the criminal case, alleging he violated multiple criminal statutes in his attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, arguing that Donald Trump possesses presidential immunity. In a 71-page late-night filing with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, Donald Trump's attorneys requested a stay of any order by the court if it disagrees with him and his claims of presidential immunity so that Donald Trump can try to make his case to the Supreme Court instead. Trump's attorneys argued the actions that Donald Trump allegedly took, according to federal prosecutors, constitute quintessential presidential acts and fell within his official duties. During the 234 years from 1789 to 2023, no current or former U.S. president has ever been criminally prosecuted for official acts. That unbroken tradition died this year, and the historical fallout is tremendous. The Trump court filing reads, "The indictment of President Trump threatens to launch cycles of recrimination and politically motivated prosecution that will plague our nation for many decades to come and stands likely to shatter the very bedrock of our republic, the confidence of American citizens in an independent judicial system." In the Saturday night court filing, Donald Trump's legal team insisted his criminal case should be dismissed because he wasn't convicted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial in 2021, claiming that would violate his protections against double jeopardy. Impeachment is a political process, not a criminal one, according to the U.S. Constitution. The latest Trump court filing comes one day after the Supreme Court declined to fast-track the landmark case determining whether Trump is absolutely immune from prosecution for any crimes he allegedly committed whilst in office. The Supreme Court's decision not to immediately take up the case allows the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to first determine whether Donald Trump can be prosecuted for his alleged efforts to alter the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. The Supreme Court is still likely to take up that question, but not imminently. The Supreme Court's decision to not weigh in for now was a blow to Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team of prosecutors. Trump first filed a motion to dismiss the indictment on grounds of presidential immunity on 5th of October. CNN cable news network has also covered this same story. Donald Trump urged a federal appeals court to throw out the federal election subversion criminal case in Washington, D.C., again arguing in a filing late on Saturday, 23rd of December, that he's protected under the presidential immunity. Trump wants the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn a lower court's ruling rejecting his claims of immunity in Special Counsel Jack Smith's election subversion case. The appeals panel is weighing Donald Trump's request, which the Supreme Court on Friday refused to take up, on an expedited basis. The court filing reiterates what the former president's lawyers have repeatedly asserted, that Donald Trump was working in his official capacity as the U.S. president to ensure election integrity when he allegedly undermined the 2020 election results and therefore has immunity, and that his indictment is unconstitutional because presidents cannot be criminally prosecuted for official acts of duty unless they're impeached and convicted by the U.S. Senate. The Constitution establishes a powerful structural check to prevent political factions from abusing the formidable threat of criminal prosecution to disable the president and attack their political enemies, Trump's attorneys wrote in the court filing. Before any single prosecutor can ask a court to sit in judgment of the president's conduct, Congress must have approved of it by impeaching and convicting the president, they wrote. That did not happen here, and so President Donald Trump has absolute immunity. The former president has been attempting to delay his 4th of March trial in the case, with his fight over the immunity claim underscoring those efforts. The appeals court has expedited its consideration of his appeal and is set to hear oral arguments in the matter on 9th of January. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, who is overseeing his criminal case, temporarily paused all procedural deadlines in the case whilst the appeal plays out. The Supreme Court on Friday rejected a request from Special Prosecutor Jack Smith for the justices to immediately hear the case before the D.C. Circuit had a chance to weigh in. Both sides will have the option of appealing the eventual ruling from the appeals court back up to the highest court in the land.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program. We are with Sheikh Javid, as always, who sheds some lights on some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But this time, as we have started a series of episodes on Khums. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. In order to evade a payment of khums on their assets, a family, a husband and a wife, sometimes decide to give each other their annual income as gifts prior to the end of their khums year. Would you please explain to our audience the rule concerning their liability to khums?
Well, it is very much clear from the example you mentioned that the husband and wife are trying to evade payment of khums, as you also mentioned it. And of course, in this very scenario, these two people are not exempted from the obligatory khums because they are giving each other's income as gifts to each other. Now, that's not okay. That's a very, very... That's very much readable and very much understandable from the fact that they are trying to avoid paying khums and they are trying to evade paying khums. They are not serious about gifting money to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And of course, in this very scenario, khums should be paid by both parties, by both individuals, the husband and the wife.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Well, a person deposited an amount of money with a Hajj travel agency in order to perform Mustahab Hajj, recommended Hajj. But unfortunately, he dies before he could visit the house of God. Shashawit, what's the ruling concerning this money? Is this money subject to khums, first of all? And then, is it obligatory for the heir to spend this money for the performance of Hajj on his behalf or her behalf?
Well, the value of the Hajj travel document obtained in exchange for the money deposited in the account of the Hajj agency is considered a part of his inheritance. And of course, we do know the rules regarding inheritance, because inheritance is something to be received by the heirs. And inheritance is not liable for khums. There's no khums paid on inheritance, no matter what the amount, and no matter what it is. It could be in the form of cash, it could be in the form of, let's say, a house or something left by the deceased person. Now, generally speaking, khums is not paid on inheritance. So it's not obligatory to spend it on performing Hajj on his behalf. Of course, if Hajj was not obligatory on him, and or when he had not made a will in this regard. And of course, when it comes to khums, if its khums has not been paid, paying its khums is obligatory in the given case, because if that money was deposited and khums was not paid, according to His Eminence, the money which was stored, which was saved for paying khums, since a year probably might have passed on it, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, paying the khums of that amount is obligatory in the very given scenario that you mentioned. Now, if it is there as an inheritance, khums is not paid on inheritance, and that inheritance should be divided by among the heirs.
I see. Thank you very much, Shashawit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest, this speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, an orchard or a garden was transferred to an individual's children, like a son, as a gift or by way of inheritance, right?
Yes.
At that time, it was not of much value. It wasn't very much like pricey then. But its present market value is much greater than its previous one. Is the excess amount now subject to khums?
According to Ayatollah Khamenei, inheritance and gifts are not subject to khums, and nor the money earned from their sale, from the proceeds, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Khums is not paid on it either. Even if the value, the market value increases, now maybe it might, sometimes it might increase manifold.
Yes.
So in that case, of course, the heirs are not supposed to pay Khums, nor the recipient of the gift, okay, is not is supposed to give to pay Khums on the increase,
right,
maybe on the market value increase. So of course, if that let's say inherited amount or inherited property is kept for trading purposes and for the increase in their value, then the situation is different. Because if that in building, let's say, a property is kept for business, okay, let's do business with this,
mm-hmm,
let's increase the amount, okay, the amount increase, the value increase, of course, that is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, of course, the heirs should, as a measure of obligatory precaution, because this is a measure, it's not a fatwa, it's just a precaution, the heirs should pay khums on the appreciation and of course and selling after it's sold to the people, after it's sold, you know.
So you mean if they consider this as an asset,
yes,
for doing business with it for a profit.
Profit,
then
yes.
The scenario changes.
The certain scenarios.
So it's not inheritance anymore, and then it's payable on khums.
Khums should be paid as a measure of obligatory precaution.
Precaution.
Because when it's precaution, it's precaution. It's not a fatwa.
Yes.
And of course, in such matters, we understand that in matters of precaution, we can refer to another mujtahid who may have a fatwa.
Yes. Well, Sheikh Chobit, another quick question that I may squeeze in fact, at the end of this episode. Someone says an insurance company owes me an amount in lieu of medical expenses, and I will receive it one of these days. Is it subject to khums?
Well, the amount paid for treatment and the like from one's income, and then, for example, it is returned by the insurance company,
mm-hmm,
are not ruled as new income. Rather,
right,
they return the very money of the person, you know, saved up with the insurance company.
Yes.
So if it's not spent on living expenses until the end of the khums year, it will be liable to khums. But if it is returned after the end of the khums year, it is khums must be paid immediately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is your money, it's saved with the insurance company, and once it's returned, or sometimes it's returned before the khums year, sometimes it's returned after the khums year. Now, if it is returned after the khums year, it's necessary that you take action to pay its khums immediately.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chobit. Thank you, my dear listeners, for choosing our channel, our IRIB English Radio, for the program Islamic Laws. And we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.